From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album. Available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, the Indiana-born author of The Princess Diaries has a new novel for grown-ups. Vess Rutenberg finally goes solo with a new album, and we meet the last APA finalist. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll hear about an unusual program that uses dance to help kids gain confidence and learn teamwork. But first, Becky and Reed haven't spoken since their fateful prom night more than a decade ago. Is it fate or something else that the one person who can help Reed save his family is the only girl he's ever loved? That's the setup for the newest novel from Bloomington native Meg Cabot. If her name rings a bell, you doubtless have a young girl in your life who tore through the Princess Diaries series over the last few years. With her new novel, The Boy Is Back, Meg mines her rich Bloomington history for the thinly disguised Bloomville, Indiana, of this story told through text messages, newspaper articles, and social media postings. Warning to any novelists listening, don't forget to change the names to protect the people you grew up with. Listen in.
So if I say epistolary novel, listeners might think, oh, kind of Jane Austen era. What inspired you to use the format that you've used?
Well, I love reading epistolary novels. I think the first one I read was Daddy Long Legs, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I love that format. I just find it so easy and fun to read. It's a little bit like reading somebody's diary. And, you know, we all like to kind of get a glimpse at something we're not supposed to be looking at. And so I wanted to write books that way. And I've been doing so since, gosh, the early 2000. I think I wrote my first one, The Boy Next Door. Mm-hmm. And it sold really well. And so I've been doing books that way, too. And, of course, The Princess Diaries is written in diary format.
Right,
so it's
right.
A fun challenge for me, and I love it.
Well, and it strikes me that that it gives you a built-in way to differentiate voices, not least because, you know, somebody's a texter and uses all those text abbreviations instead of actually spelling out the words.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of fun, and it really is like reading you know, somebody else's text messages. It's like you've grabbed somebody else's phone and you're getting a glimpse into their lives. It's really fun.
Guilty pleasures.
Yeah.
So let's talk about you still have friends in Bloomington.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Well, yeah, actually, I have a house there right outside Bloomington in Ellettsville, or Elitesville, as I like to call it. And yeah, I get back a lot and see my old friends. And we go to Indiana University basketball games quite a bit, too.
Sure. Does anybody read your novels and say, hey, that's a thinly disguised portrait of our buddy?
Oh, unfortunately, yes. In fact, I accidentally used the name of someone that I went to high school with in this book, and I totally just spaced it, and she's actually a very evil character. She's not in real life at all, but I had a book signing in Bloomington the very first day that this book came out, and several people from my high school showed up, and they said, hey, do you realize what you did? And I was mortified. It was so embarrassing.
It isn't the one who's...
I still owe her an apology.
It's not the one who's the super mom, is it?
Yes.
Now she's really famous.
No, I think people told me that she actually thought it was hilarious. And she, I just actually owe her a book, by the way. I need to send that to her with an apology.
Well, I love that while it's cheerful, it's fun, it's a light read, but you actually do fabulous job of using the lightness and the joy of the journey to bring up some subjects like what happens to us as we age and how do we care for our elderly parents who maybe have one cat too many or one collectible too many.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious subject, actually. There's a romance in it, and there's, as you said, a lot of humor. Thank you for pointing that out. But it is a serious subject, and it's something that a lot of people that I know, including, I will point out, myself and my husband, that we've been struggling with. And it's not something that people talk about a lot. And I really wanted to write a book about it because I felt like maybe it would make things a little bit easier for people who are going through it, and that you can see the humor in it at the same time, but also address it in a way with warmth and, you know, a little bit of compassion.
And the elder characters who are at the center of the story, or one of the parts at the center of this story, are not just older parents of some of the characters. They are community leaders, a famous judge. And so it just exacerbates the problem of, if this guy's losing it, how do we treat him with respect and yet help him along and help them figure out a way to live that maintains their dignity?
Well, right. And that's kind of the point, too, is that it can happen to anyone. And sometimes in our society, people, it's hidden because there are people who are in a person in this story is a judge, and he's so respected in the community that even some of the doctors just kind of glance over it and don't believe that he really does have a problem, because he's always been such a great, again, leader in the community. And that's so frustrating for the children who are involved, because they're trying to say, well, some of them are in denial,
right?
Some of them are trying to say, hey, dad really does have a problem, and they can't even really get the doctors to go along with it because the doctors hold him in such great esteem. So it can be so frustrating on so many levels when you're dealing with that kind of situation, that ultimately what happens is that the children have to hire a senior specialist, who of course turns out to be one of the siblings' ex-girlfriends. So that even exacerbates the problem more. So I'm not saying it's a true story, but it's something that could happen in a small town. And there's so many different levels of difficulty. So it was a fun story to tell, but it could be a story that could turn out to be true in so many people's lives, because it's happening more and more to so many people these days.
Hey, I don't want to give anything away, so I'm going to be careful about how I ask this question. Might we know a future chapter of Becky or Reed's life?
I don't really have a sequel with those particular characters in the works, but I definitely love writing these kinds of books, and I love writing about, you know, small town drama. And what I do like to do is occasionally have other characters mention that they know these people and what's going on in their lives, and so sometimes it does happen. Yeah, so we may find out a little bit more about what's going on with these people in a future book. We never know.
Bloomington, born Meg Cabot, author of the wildly popular Princess Diaries novels, and of this new novel aimed at a grown-up audience. You can find The Boy Is Back wherever you buy books. Five years ago, a determined young man named Michael Johnson came to Indianapolis with a mission to change the lives of young people through the discipline of dance. And thus, Kids Dance Outreach, or KDO, was born. It's a unique program. It takes place during school hours at school, so no child is denied the opportunity to not only learn how to dance, but to build self-esteem, trust, and cooperation. Every few months, KDO gives a program where several classes merge, creating another chance for kids to learn how to become a team. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer spent several hours with the creator and students during one of their rehearsals.
Five, six, here we go!
The sounds of tennis shoes and tambourines echo through the back room at the Athenaeum as 40 kids of all sizes, shapes, and color practice a series of lively dance routines.
To keep kids focused on positive things that they're getting a sense of accomplishment and achievement from.
That's KDO founder and instructor Michael Johnson.
I've been in the dance world my entire life, and professional with the Boston Ballet for 10 years, and then teaching in Boston's outreach programs, where I saw all of Boston Public Schools, Boston Independent and Charter Schools. So I'd seen pretty much everything, every aspect of what is involved when it comes to high quality dance outreach. And I kind of found my way to connect with the children, to motivate them, to inspire them to want to do better for themselves.
In 2012, he moved to Indianapolis to see if what he knew worked there could succeed here.
We have a combination. We do residencies inside of some elementary schools that do have a suitable space. However, many of the schools come to us during school time. They come to us at the Athenaeum building, and we have our class here. And they come to us once a week for 10 weeks, and each week is progressive. So by the end of the 10th week, they're ready for a showcase in which the community and their families and the school community is also invited to come and watch and witness their accomplishments and what they've been learning over the past 10 weeks.
That was excellent.
Ayana is a fifth grader at School 79.
Makes me feel happy.
Her mom, Karina, thought it was an offer too good to pass up.
She's never really had structured dancing practice or instruction, so I thought that would be a good exposure for her.
Johnson says the purpose is to empower kids.
I think that we've found a great balance and a great challenging way for them to understand and learn discipline. So when we present our challenges, we do it in a fun and inspiring way, an energetic and joyful way.
Fourth graders Annie and Jack agree.
I think it's really fun, and I didn't expect it to be this much fun, but then when I started doing it, it was a lot more fun than I expected.
When I come to class, it's just stay focused and to not goof around so much, and when I get out of class, it's like I had so much fun, and I'm so tired, and it was just an awesome class.
His mom, Sarah, sees a big difference, too.
It's just been really great for his confidence and his coordination and just meeting new people, making new friends. And he's really enjoying the performances in the city, getting to go to some great places. And it's been a wonderful opportunity for our family.
Annie's mom, Kelly, says the best part is that KDO welcomes all kids.
And Annie's had dance experience, but some kids haven't. And how great to tap into something that they had no idea that they could do or had an interest in. Or, you know, she says that it relieves her of the math stress, but dance is math, and it's phys ed, and it's language, and it's music, and it's everything in one. I mean, I can see how kids could get lost in this in a great way.
KDO holds its annual dance party for all ages to raise money on Saturday, April 15th. It'll be in the Park Tudor School Varsity Gym from 6 to 9 p.m., and you can learn more at its website, kidsdanceoutreach.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, and I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, a stellar pianist who's also a math whiz. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Josh Ratliff, IMA's Director of Hospitality, about their new beer garden offerings.
What we haven't done before are food and beverage style programming. So with, you know, making the museum more accessible, the first thing I thought of was, you know, we need to do something like we're a neighbor to the city. And what do you do with a neighbor? You have them over for a beer on your back porch. And so, you know, the greenhouse is kind of out there in our yard, and it's kind of like a back porch. And so the beer garden was kind of born out of that, saying, like, come over for a beer and just say hi, or a brewed beverage of some sort, coffee, tea, beer, or whatnot. So
you have a beer garden now that is attached to the or near the greenhouse or a part of the greenhouse. Tell me how it works.
So the beer garden is, first and foremost, is a part of the garden experience. So everything about how do you get into it or out to it or when's it open, it's a proponent of this new loop around our gardens or pathway. And the rear garden is set, you know, 6-7 minute walk, depending on how fast you need a beer out there on the campus. And it's right, it's like the front porch of the greenhouse. A lot of members and longtime IMA goers are going to know it as the former, like, shade area where all the plants were. And when we were looking for locations to do a food and beverage operation, that shade, all the comes from the pergola slats, that I was like, this is great to stand under and be under. And so we took the existing cedar and kind of took it apart and put it back together to make tables that are fixed like a beer garden. And really that pergola kind of solidified the beer garden as the right path to go down. So the repurposed part of the greenhouse is there. And
so people walk up and they can actually order a beer or wine, right?
Right, yeah. So the outdoor experience, the taps, everything that you're, you know, coming to see, or a snack, or big soft tear and share pretzel, can be experienced there at the beer garden. It's like a counter service, like a lot of models I'm seeing in like Louisville, where you get in line, you can order everything, it's delivered to your table, and then if you want something else, you just get back in line. That helps us monitor the legal side, which is a whole new thing for me coming from a corporate area where it's all very tight controls on all the hospitality. Here, it's, you know, we're open to the public, and so the big learning curve there was, how do we design it so it's all ages, because that's really important to me, but also be intuitive and easy to use for the guest and legal. So the counter service works, and there are four taps. One is a root beer from Triton. There's a wine on tap, which is, I think, a great thing. Even as like a snob about wine, I really think that keg wine helps solve a problem. And it gets, a lot of people say, like, what's on tap when they sit down at restaurants now. And I love being able to say a wine in that list, because I think wine has a, not so dissimilar from a museum, wine has this fancy writing, and it's in a bottle, and there's a ritual, and there's a cork, and there's...
So being on tap makes it more accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. We'll see if people go for it. It's a dry Riesling from upstate New York. And then you have a custom brew from Sun King, which is...
Yeah, tell me about that. It has a special name, right? Brewed just for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Among the Leaves is an ale. So, like, it's a part... They're using their native yeast program. So they're pulling and cultivating yeasts like Brettanomyces and some other yeasts that are just naturally in Indiana air floating around. And so it's finishing fermentation, I think, today. And yeah, and it'll be available only here. You can taste it at their tap rooms to get a sample. And then the final one is, you know, it's a beer garden. I wanted to tip my cap to Germany. So we got a traditional Pilsner from Warsteiner.
And like you said, the pretzels, right?
Yeah, so these are from Pat's Philly Pretzels. He's been making pretzels here for a long time, and he's doing a custom pretzel for us. It's giant tear and share. Like, I would challenge, I'm a big eater, but I would challenge anybody to finish this by themselves.
The IMA's Beer Garden is open through May 31st, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, and noon to 5 on Sundays. The American Pianists Awards, sponsored by the Indianapolis-based American Pianists Association, take place at Hilbert Circle Theater on April 7th and 8th. The week before, each of the five finalists will take part in performances, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer has been talking with each of the finalists leading up to the Discovery Week and Gala Finals. We're meeting our last finalist, who's not just a master of his digits at the keyboard, Jill.
You could say that, Sharon.
Yes, I indeed. Just did.
Alex Beyer, yes, he's definitely a master of the piano, but he is a whiz at mathematics, so much so that he is actually double majoring at Harvard.
Math was something that I always loved. And so in the last couple of years, just taking some incredible math classes, really pretty strong department at Harvard. And so moved my way from sort of statistics and more applied math to pure math, and it's been really enjoyable.
Alex says both require a lot of time and effort, but in a way, each provides a relief for the other.
The math really gets my brain going and helps my concentration for when I want to step into the practice room. And then, of course, you know, the music is such a nice place to be able to go when, you know, you're tired of the academic stuff. And it's especially to be able to do it at a high level with a great teacher. I've been so lucky. You know, it's almost they're both are sort of this sort of boundless forms of human achievement and sort of ongoing human achievement. And so I'm really lucky to take part in both.
Do you want to try to pursue the piano as long as you can for a career, or because you're so interested in environmental science and math, is that really going to be more your career?
Well, so I think the way in which like they've practically sort of helped each other out, I've been able to maintain my sanity through college actually, and I think that's they've worked together in that way. So at this point, I'm just you know taking all the opportunities I can to perform, and finishing you know the degree. But my priority, I think, is to try to you know perform as much as I can and see where it goes.
His deep interest in music history started in high school. He organized monthly talks where he would share information about the composer with his audience before his performance. That exploration has intensified since he's been at Harvard.
The one thing that I sort of have really grasped onto is trying to find the influences that are culminating in the work of a particular composer. So now I've sort of extended the scope and I'm interested in all periods of music history. I mean, really more from Bach onward. The Renaissance stuff is super interesting, but I've focused on the stuff that I can actually play. And it is, in a way, it's an applied study because you sort of get to know these influences behind the music, and then that is obviously helpful in the interpretation of it.
And that ability comes in handy as each finalist chooses the composer and the music that he wants to perform during the Discovery Week recitals and the gala finals.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and it's been so much fun to be a part of the whole thing.
Yeah. Were you friends with any of the finalists before? Did you know them before?
Yeah, I was friends with Henry Kramer. And
you guys were in a competition together.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And I mean, I think I'm the more zealous one in that friendship. Like, I sort of cling after him more than he would to me, but because he's friends with everybody. But he's great, and I also sort of know tangentially the others, so it's really nice.
Now, of course, Alex was joking a little bit there about his friendship with Henry Kramer, but they actually all do get along very well. Although the first time that they're actually all going to be together for an extended period of time is this coming week, the big Discovery series. And there is a lot on the line, though, because the winner, remember, of the fellowship gets a contract, money, branding, and really the ability to continue their future as a professional pianist, not just as something that they really enjoy doing, and a lot of them obviously teaching as well.
And most of them probably have access to a good piano, but they also get a Steinway picked out just for that person.
Indeed. Yeah. And you can hear Alex's premiere performance on Sunday night, April the 2nd at 7 o'clock, and then the Discovery Series starts taking place in downtown Indianapolis. The concerts are live every day at noon at Christ Church Cathedral downtown, and then we will rebroadcast them at 7 o'clock on 90.1.
And just a reminder, those concerts are also free, and you can just kind of step in and step out if you don't have time to stay for the whole concert.
And they're all playing different music at each of the concerts this year for the first time. None of them selected to play the same piece, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
And within a couple of those concerts as well, there are extra musicians and vocalists and all different kinds of things. So
fantastic.
A great way to hear some wonderful music.
I can't believe Discovery Week is here already, but if for some crazy reason piano doesn't do it for you, I don't know that that's even possible, but we have some other suggestions on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
So I know you're probably just getting past spring break with younger people in your life, but it's time to think about summer. Already. Butler Community Art School is offering Theater Camp 2 Focus on Shakespeare for the first time this summer for students in grades 9 through 12. It's one of 16 arts and music-related camps being offered on the Butler University campus this summer.
And most of those summer camps, which include focus on percussion, piano, bass, jazz, voice, theater, woodwinds, strings, brass, most of those are for kids. But there's an adult big band workshop the week of June 4th, and you can find out more and apply for those summer camps at Butler University's website, butler.edu.
If you enjoy art, science, and your brain, you might want to think about spending some time the weekend of April 8th and 9th. It's the 21st Century Great Conversations in Neuroscience, Art, and Related Therapeutics. Now, there are going to be industry people there because students underneath any of those sciences are going to be able to get credit. But these conversations are open to the public as well. And what is happening with these conversations is they're really trying to find a way to take all the wonderful, interesting new things that we've learned about the brain and art therapy and how those two things can be integrated and then actually used within the public setting. It's a fascinating two-day seminar, April 8th and the 9th, down on the IUPUI campus. And you can go to the Indiana University School of Medicine, their website, for more information on these 21st Century Great Conversations, or check out their Facebook page as well.
Now, back a century or so ago, if you said to your friend, "I'm going to a Schubertiad tonight," what that meant was you were going to a concert that was all, or at least mostly, music by Schubert. And if you're hearing us on our Saturday broadcast, you can do that this coming Tuesday night, the 4th, at 7:30 in the Wood Room of Hilbert Circle Theater. The Ronan Chamber Ensemble is performing a sonatina for violin and piano. Gregory Martin's the pianist, Austin Hartman's the violinist. Five Schubert Lieder sung by mezzo-soprano Mitzi Westra with Gregory Martin at the piano. And a couple of more not-to-be-missed Schubert pieces. That's all coming up Tuesday evening at 7:30 at the Wood Room of Hilbert Circle Theater.
On Saturday, April the 8th, from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Inspire Gallery in Carmel, Sean Gray will be there demonstrating his pottery. And many of you remember the conversation that I had with Sean and his mother, Sylvia Gray, who is a very talented artist in and of herself. Sean suffers from autism, and his pottery making has really been the saving grace for his life. And he has made a successful business out of it as well. So he's going to be giving pottery demonstrations that night from 5 to 9 at the Inspire Gallery. And then the following week, on April the 15th, Sylvia Gray is actually going to be demonstrating the beautiful painting on silk scarves that she does as well.
It's a double hit. I love that. Both of the Gray family members. Hey, you know, Indianapolis is getting more diverse by the minute, and I'm always reminded of that when I see the vast number of film festivals that we host, including April 7th through the 29th, the IUPUI Italian Film Festival. A wide variety of films, including short films, full-length films, drama, comedy, science fiction, you name it. There's probably an offering between April 7th and the 29th on IUPUI's campus at the Lilly Auditorium. The films are in their original Italian with English subtitles. So if you speak a word of Italian or you want to practice, that's great. And if you don't and you just want to see some films that you didn't get to see at the local cinema, that's something to check out as well. You can find out more at Italian Film Fests, that's plural, italianfilmfests.org.
Meanwhile, April the 7th is the first Friday in downtown Indianapolis, and at the Full Circle 9 Gallery in the Circle City Industrial Complex, the featured artist is going to be photographer Kimberly Ewing, and her show is Paradise at Last. It goes from 6 to 9 p.m. that night. Admission is free, and she is actually dedicating her show to her supervisor, the late Bob Kaiser. He was the president and CEO of the Starfish Initiative, which works with students to prevent bullying in schools. And he was kind of a visionary to her, and so Kimberly is dedicating her exhibit to him, and her photographs are Paradise at Last. She just came back from a vacation in Hawaii, so that's what you're going to get to see when you go to Full Circle 9 Gallery on First Friday.
We're accustomed to going over to Old National Center for concerts, but here's something a little different. In the Egyptian Room on Saturday, April 8th, if you're a little twisty, listen up. Well, you've probably been listening the whole time if you're a little twisty, right? It's a Quentin Tarantino double feature at the Egyptian Room on Saturday night, the 8th. They're going to screen Pulp Fiction and Inglourious Basterds. And if you go online ahead of time or give them a call ahead of time, you can get four packs at a discount, or just pay $10 per person at the door, and something a little bit different, Quentin Tarantino double feature.
And one other First Friday show out in Pendleton. It's the Pendleton Artists Society. Their gallery is going to be open from 7 to 9. Elements is the show theme for April. A brand new exhibit and a great little place to go see art just outside of Indianapolis in Pendleton.
We have so many more suggestions, but we are out of time, so I'll remind you that you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or tune in again next week to see what we have for you on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Wes Rutenberg's been playing rock and roll in Indianapolis for more than 30 years. His musical resume includes bands like The Pieces, United States 3, Zero Boys, The Lemonheads, and Dow Jones and the Industrials. After years of making music and performing under different monikers, he recently wrote and self-produced his first solo album called Tremendous Downtime. He'll be debuting songs from that album at 9 p.m. on Friday, April 7th at the State Street Pub, as contributor Ben Schein discovered.
Vess, you've got a whole album's worth of new music and a show on April 7th at State Street Pub. Tell me a little bit about your new music and the songs you're going to be playing.
Well, I finally decided to get a record together of my own recordings, with me playing everything and doing everything, and not calling it a band. I don't know why. For some reason, I just wanted to finally just... I guess I hadn't done it before. And I got Casey Tennis and Adam Gross to play with me, who are just so great, and... it's going to be really fun. It's just a really great band, and it's a nice collection of new songs. And as a solo artist, I can kind of do whatever I want to, because I could never do that when I was in a band.
So, yeah, think about it. Let's talk about the songs. Think about this new batch of songs. Do you have a different approach now from when you were maybe a little younger? I mean, you told me leading up to this, you said, I'm 48 years old and I'm going solo.
Yeah.
What's different about writing songs now versus when you were 22 or 23 years old?
That's interesting. I don't know. They used to come a lot quicker and more effortlessly, but now when they do come, they mean more to me. I'm just not as carefree. It's like if you just, someone handed you a $100 bill every hour, at one point you wouldn't be so precious about them if someone gave them to you once a week.
Are you more meticulous now in your songwriting, or you have higher standards for what makes a good song or a good verse or chorus?
I'm more bored with myself, and so it takes a little longer for me to really make myself want to do something and get surprised and happy. That's the main thing, is that I have to impress myself after all these years, which is really hard.
Well, how do you know when you're impressed? Like, how do you know when a song is done? When do you meet your own standards as a songwriter then?
Well, this is something you'll hear from songwriters, is that the good ones you don't really labor over. The good ones come out of the air. You run in from out from the car and try to get it down as quick as you can because it's just in your head. So really that's when they meet the standards of wanting to – when you want to get it done, when you can't wait to wake up the next morning and finish it, kind of thing.
Well, you know, traditionally you've written and performed as a band, even when you were the principal songwriter, in bands like the United States 3 and The Pieces. And this new album is working under just your own name. What made you come out from behind the curtain now?
Well, I've always played drums, I've always played bass and done those things. But one thing that was, I had time at 9 o'clock in the morning to get up and go play. And a lot of my friends and associates are at work or doing something else. And I just ended up playing everything on a collection of songs. And I thought, well, there's no sense in pretending. This is a solo record.
And, right now I would describe you as a seasoned veteran. I mean, you're a seasoned musician.
I love seasoning.
You've put out albums since the 80s. You've toured the world with famous rock bands like the Zero Boys and the Lemonheads. And lately, it seems like you're working with some younger musicians locally. What's that been like, and what have you been doing?
Well, I always like to think I'm playing with good musicians. And when I was a young 18-year-old, when I joined the Zero Boys, they were all vastly older. They were late 20s, early 30s. You know, they were old geezers to my 18-year-old self. Maybe there's just something to it, to playing with different ages and all that kind of thing. But also, one of the things I like so much about being a musician is if you can play, you're in the club. It's not a lot about like, oh, he's old or he's young or that's a girl or that or anything like that. It's about if you can do it, you're in.
Come well, you've on, done some busy. Of it lately with some younger groups, like your EP in the Weekend, where you worked with some.
That's right. Yeah, that was super. We did with Sir Deja Duke and
Caleb McCoach.
Caleb McCoach. Yeah, it was so great. Well, even more so, those were people that I hadn't even met before. I just heard some of their music and I thought this would be really fun.
What was that like? So EP in the Weekend, you guys get together. You've never played together before, and you make a group of songs together in a weekend.
Yeah. You have a weekend to write, record, perform the whole thing. So we sat down and we wrote a concept, and then we went to different corners and we wrote songs. We got back together and we got busy, and we had it mixed by Sunday afternoon. It was
That's really great.
Cool.
So Edwin the Duck, another musical adventure you're doing?
Yes. This is how I got familiar with Adam, who's playing with me on April 7th. He and I did a bunch of children's songs for Edwin the Duck, a Pylab toy out of Carmel, Indiana. And there'll be more on that in the future, but that's been really fun. Being a father, finally, after all these years, has made me realize how annoying kids' music is. And I thought this would be a good chance to maybe add some, maybe hopefully less annoying music to, you know,
for future generations.
And for the parents, you know, the parents, poor parents.
And you mentioned Adam, who you're playing with on the 7th. That's Adam from SM Wolf?
Yeah, correct.
Small studio session promotion there for SM Wolf.
Small studio man, Adam Gross, that's right.
So, Vess, thanks for stopping by. I'm looking forward to your show on April 7th. What advice would you give to younger musicians right now?
Follow your inspiration. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, but it's okay to try new things.
I think that really is the end of it. Vess, looking forward to your show, State Street Pub, April 7th. Really appreciate you coming by today.
Thanks, man.
It's okay to try new things. Hey, it's okay to try new things. It's okay to try new things. It's okay to try new things. It's okay to try new things lately. It's okay to try new things. Hey,
contributor Ben Schein with musician Vess Rutenberg. Rutenberg will be performing songs from his new solo album, Tremendous Downtime, at 9 p.m. on Friday, April 7th at the State Street Pub. The Indiana Historical Society recently unearthed a little-known but fascinating piece of our state's history. In 1943, approximately 3,000 Italian prisoners of war were held at Indiana's Camp Atterbury. They worked as farmers, interacted with Hoosiers, and even built their own chapel, which still stands. The Historical Society has recreated this piece of history in its latest You Are There exhibit. The Art of the Matter's contributor Mark Allen talked to the Historical Society's Museum Theater Director, Daniel Shockley, and one of the reenactors, Mike Redmond, to find out more.
So Mike and I were having lunch with a couple of friends a few weeks ago, and he started telling us this story about the Italian soldiers, the POWs in Camp Atterbury, and the common reaction around the table was, what? How come we don't know about this? Wait, you're making this up. But obviously, he's not. So, Daniel, how'd you hear about this? I guess we should start by
Well,
asking.
Your reaction is the common reaction. We had a member opening for our Ellis Ayres exhibit about 2 years ago. And after that was over, one of our members walked up and said, what do you know about Camp Atterbury? And I said, well, I know that the National Guard trains there, and that was really it. He said, well, let me take you down there sometime. So we made a date, and we went down, and he glad-handed me to probably 15 people, and in that process, we toured their museum. They have a museum there on the Camp Atterbury property, and in the museum, there's a story of this chapel. And I asked about it. In the chapel, was built in 1943 by Italian prisoners of war who were captured in the African campaign and brought here to Indiana. And that chapel is the only remaining structure still on the Camp Atterbury grounds of the POW camp that housed, at that time, 3,000 Italian POWs.
So your reaction was what?
Shock like everyone else. And I immediately wanted to see it. So we hopped in the car and drove about 2 minutes to the area where the chapel still stands. And it is small, much smaller than you would ever imagine, and beautiful when you think about just its physical beauty. But then when you think about why it was built, who wanted it built, and what that chapel meant to the lives of these men who were so far from home, who didn't know if their home even stood or even if their city still existed. Where were their families? Where were their loved ones? It was a chapel that really kind of helped them, I believe, through this loss and fear and grief, and gave them hope and a sense of peace in some ways.
So was it well known at the time that Camp Atterbury was housing POWs?
It certainly wasn't a secret, because due to the shortage of men working the farms, the prisoners of war were able to work on farms in at first a 25-mile radius to Camp Atterbury. And so we're actually, our characters, who are the Italians in our space, are POWs who actually worked on a farm in the New Whiteland area.
Okay. So how does an exhibit, is exhibit the right word for
yes.
this? Okay. How does an exhibit like this come together?
This is it's a two-year process. We try to have 2 years out from an exhibit opening to kind of put all the pieces together. And certainly in this instance, you know, there's the Catholic piece, and there's the Italian piece, and there's the military piece and the war piece. It's such a wide research topics that it takes about 2 years to start to narrow down, so that when we open, the doors open and our guests can walk into this recreation of a chapel in our building at the Historical Society and meet some of the actors playing the Italians or the American military.
Okay. Mike, what's the preparation been like for this?
It's a semester's worth of history crammed into 4 weeks. We have to learn not only the history of the prisoner of war camp, but we have to be aware of what's going on in the world at that time, what's going on militarily in World War II. In the case of some of us, the Italian prisoners of war and myself, we have to learn a smattering at least of Italian. My character, Father Imhoff, was fluent in Italian. And then because this is pre-Vatican II, I also need a little Latin, so I'm brushing that off or blowing the dust off of it. But the preparation is intense. I mean, we go at it every day and just cram, basically.
And the idea is that when visitors get there, you are the person.
Exactly. And it has to be automatic on our part. You know,
yeah.
We have to be convincible. We're real.
So what have you done? Tell us a few things that you've done to prepare.
I have bought copies of Latin for Dummies and Italian for Dummies. No, I've been brushing up on my languages. I did take Latin in school, and Italian is close enough to Spanish that I'm beginning. I have brushed up on church history. I have brushed up on the personal history of my character, Father Imhoff. Luckily, his family has a great genealogy site, so I can find a lot of material about his life and use that to embody him when people come in.
Yeah. Now, you've done reenactments before.
Yes, I have. This is my fourth.
Society. So what do people generally do? I mean, do they accept you as a character, or do they want to talk to you about current events? And
you know, it's a person-by-person thing. Some people really get into it, and they come in and they play along, and that's great. That is wonderful when that happens. Some people, it's difficult for them. The getting into it and getting into that other time period and these and you just deal with that as best you can, always being polite and friendly and happy and everything. But like I said, it's a individual thing.
Yeah. Daniel, what do you want people to take away from this?
I really want people to take away an understanding of that time period and to, first of all, know it even existed, that we had 3,000 Italian prisoners of war here in Indiana at that time. And when they were shipped out of Indiana, they were replaced by 8,000 to 9,000 German POWs. Again, something people just don't know. But what I really hope is that people see the sense of hope that these gentlemen had, and their humanity is no different than anyone else's. I believe that people will make comparisons between what was happening in the 1940s with World War II and what's happening right now, with some of the rhetoric and some of the things being said. It was certainly a time when we were all looking at who the other was, and I believe in some ways we're in a time where we're looking at who the other is. And I would like people to kind of make some of those comparisons and draw their own conclusion.
Okay. Yeah, and actually you almost answered, or you started to answer my last question. Was I was looking at this Italian genealogy website, and it said that after the war, the Italian soldiers were replaced with 10,000 German soldiers. So I was going to ask you, is that the next exhibition? Or is Mike going to have to learn German now?
Already speak it.
Actually, coming up next is an exhibit based on a collection of letters we have at the Indiana Historical Society written by Captain David Beam, who was fighting in the Civil War. And so that's our next collection. So we're still in a war area, but we're going to go back a few more years.
The Indiana Historical Society's new exhibit, You Are There, 1943, Italian POWs at Atterbury, runs through August 11th of next year at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center in downtown Indianapolis. For more information, visit indianahistory.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined by musician and composer Eric Salazar. Eric, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Eric, you were on Cultural Manifesto last year to talk about your solo work, but right now I want to focus on your work with Forward Motion, a classical indie music ensemble. Mm-hmm. And Forward Motion is performing Saturday, April 8th at the Musical Family Tree Space on the second floor of the Murphy Building in Fountain Square. The show starts at 8. It's an all-ages event and $10 at the door. But you can buy advance tickets if you're really on the ball. Go to the Eventbrite link. And Eric, you have five songs to share with us tonight. What's your first song?
My first song is Ain't No Grave by Johnny Cash.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.
I just love the darkness and defiance of the way Johnny Cash sings this.
Ain't no grave can hold my body down.
Your second pick, Eric.
Okay, so this is a strange one. It's called Orphan Camel Cult by a Russian group called Namgar. And the reason that I love this is because before I heard this song, I had never heard people sing like the way the female vocalist sings in this piece. Well, I gotta have something classical in here, and it's one of my all-time favorites. Symphony No. 9 in E minor from The New World, the fourth movement, Allegro con fuoco. It just sounds like movie music before there were movies.
And this is Dvorak, right?
Yes, New World Antonin Dvorak. Yeah. Thank you.
fourth song, Eric?
This is Hunting Bears by Radiohead, and I love it because it's so introspective.
Final song, Eric Salazar.
Yeah, so I also have to have some video game music in here.
Okay.
This is Hymn of the Faith but from Final Fantasy X by Nobuo Uematsu. And it's amazing to me how this video game piece can invoke such emotion.
As I mentioned, your ensemble, Forward Motion, will be performing Saturday, April 8th at the Musical Family Tree Space on the second floor of the Murphy Building in Fountain Square. The show starts at 8 o'clock. Anything you want to tell people about Forward Motion and the kinds of music you guys are playing?
Yeah, so we focus on newly composed music. We call the genre indie classical, and we just feel like this is the music of our time. It's composers writing music in these years for our people. So that's why we play it.
And Eric, where can folks keep up with you online?
Yeah, so my website is ericsalazarclarinet.com. I have a Facebook page, Eric Salazar Clarinet. I just got up to 11,000 followers on that.
Awesome.
So you can join the party. And if you want to keep up with Forward Motion, we have a Facebook page, Forward Motion.
Excellent. I love the mix of music you played today. So thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Here, Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Jill Dittmeyer, and Ben Schein. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll meet an artist who's inspired by science and get sneak previews of Butler Arts Fest and Comic-Con. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.